Hey there, welcome to Friday. It's time for KOW's Week in Review, where we figure out what the heck happened this weekend, what about it matters, what should you know. I'm Bill Radke, and I got my guests here. Erica C. Barnett writes at thecisforcrank.com. Hey, Erica.
Hey, Bill.
Nick Licata, five-term Seattle City Councilman, author of Becoming a Citizen Activist. Nice to see you, Nick.
Good to be here.
Chris Vance, former chair of the Washington State Republican Party, King County Councilman, bunch of other stuff.
State legislator. You always leave that out.
Why would I do that?
I don't know. You just don't care about
Olympians. I leap from state Republican Party down to county council.
You just don't care about Olympia, clearly. So
that is a myth. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW, so join us there. And let's talk about what happened this week, starting with Washington State continuing to be a raspberry seed in Donald Trump's wisdom tooth. Our attorney general, as you know, successfully sued the president over his travel ban. This week, Seattle's mayor sued Trump over the president's executive order against so-called sanctuary cities for how they do or don't cooperate with federal immigration agents. The U.S. Attorney General said that so-called sanctuary cities like Seattle could lose billions of federal dollars overall if they don't cooperate more with the feds. And this is Mayor Ed Murray.
This administration has created an atmosphere of anxiety in cities across America and has created chaos in our politics. It is time for cities to stand up and ask the courts to put an end to the anxiety in our communities and the chaos in our system.
Murray and his city attorney say Seattle doesn't have to do the Fed's immigration enforcement job and that Trump has no right to punish cities by withholding federal funding. Let's start with former city council member Nick Licata. How is Seattle, quote, shielding, as Trump says, shielding undocumented immigrants?
Well, let's first understand that a lot of people think of a sue as suing the government. All we did was go to the court and basically say, look, they can't cut money from the city if we're basically following the Constitution. The Sessions was giving a speech the other day basically saying that he wanted jurisdictions to be punished who denied what he's referring to as detainer requests. But that is a voluntary program.
And that's when, will you explain what a detainer request
is? A detainer request is when someone's in jail and the feds ask to come in and have the city or the county basically hold those people beyond what they would normally be held with. And it's been pointed out that that's really unconstitutional unless there's a warrant. If there's no warrant signed by a judge, then basically you're denying someone a right. And this whole context of being a sanctuary city needs to be clarified. It's not a legal term. In fact, the mayor said that we're a sanctuary city by reason of what we passed in 2003, legislation that actually I wrote, saying that we would not have our city employees asking anyone what their immigrant status was, except for police, if they felt that that person had created a felony. It's a very reasonable standard, and it's one that I think the other cities that are labeled sanctuary cities are following.
Erica, anything to add to that?
Well, I think that, you know, that Seattle is fighting Trump sort of, I mean, it's both a symbolic thing that Mayor Ed Murray has decided to do on every front to say that, you know, that this is a war against cities. But it's also a money question. I mean, Jeff Sessions has said we'll withhold all these DOJ funds from the city. That's about $2.6 million.
And in Seattle?
In Seattle. And that pays for things like domestic violence programs. That pays for things like prosecuting pimps and sex traffickers. So, I mean, it's both symbolic and it's real. And the mayor and has said many times, and other city council members have agreed, that they're willing to give up every penny in federal funding that the city receives. But I think that they won't have to, because I think that this, you know, will be shown to be unconstitutional. They have a couple of good constitutional claims, one of which that Nick didn't mention is the fact that this coerces the city into acting a certain way by threatening to withhold federal funds that are unrelated to immigration. And that's the second constitutional claim that they're making. And I think that's, you know, I'm not an attorney, but I think that's a pretty strong case.
Republican Chris Vance, how strong is Seattle's case against the administration?
As I understand it, it's very strong. And this also involves King County. In fact, in some ways, it involves King County more, because there's a big program where the federal government reimburses counties for housing federal inmates. It's called SCAP funding. And a big municipal county like King County benefits from that. This is not just unconstitutional. It's against the black letter of the law, as I understand it. I can't speak intelligently on Seattle's ordinance, but I know for an absolute fact that when King County wrote their legislation, they wrote it intentionally so they would not be in violation of federal law because they did not want to lose their federal funds. I happened to be with the executive the other night, and Executive Constantine said to me, "We're doing everything that the federal government requires us to do by law." The Trump administration wants local governments to go beyond the law and do things that they don't have to do and don't want to do. And they don't have a legal leg to stand on, as I understand it. So I think, again, if this gets pressed all the way to court, I think the Trump administration loses again.
Basically, when can the federal government tell a city to enforce, detain, hand over, et cetera, and when can they not?
I think it's when they have a warrant. And I mean, at least that's the way the city has interpreted it. And, you know, if there is a warrant for a criminal offense, they are willing to cooperate with ICE. If it's a civil offense or if there's no warrant at all, a detainer is not a formal process by which, you know, that the city has to cooperate with.
And I think in the jail, that what you end up with is someone is arrested on a minor local offense and would normally spend a day in jail. ICE will say, no, we think this person might be here without documentation. Please hold them an extra 5 days until we get over there. And King County's saying, no, we're not going to do that. They're not legally obligated to do that. And so that's the big issue for the county. But then again, of course, there's the issue constantly is apparently the Trump administration wants every law enforcement officer to do what they started to do in Arizona, which is ask everyone your immigration status when you're pulled over or whatever. And I don't think anybody in this region is going
to
do that.
Well, I think we have to keep in mind, too, that immigration enforcement is a responsibility of the federal government, not local governments, and that when you try to basically federalize local police, you're doing just the opposite of what Trump and many of his supporters believe about shrinking government. You're actually expanding government and intervening in local decision-making.
In local control. President Trump says shielding undocumented immigrants makes us less safe. The King County Sheriff and others say when immigrants won't cooperate with police as witnesses, as victims, as community members, that makes us less safe. Is that Republican Vance, you're nodding your head?
That's exactly right. And that's what law enforcement says consistently is just to enforce the law, they need the cooperation of citizens to show up and you know, to testify and to report crimes. And you know, women need to feel like they can report domestic violence without getting their immigration status checked. And so that's why law enforcement, not just here, but all over the country, hates this thing.
Yeah, not universal, but I have heard it in red from some red state law enforcement.
Well, the police officers themselves.
Every place other than Maricopa County in Arizona.
Right. Now, police officers themselves, actually, when I was writing the legislation, came up and said the biggest hurdle they have in solving any kind of crime is the lack of people who know who have committed a crime coming forward and giving them information. If people fear going to the local police because they be in the country undocumented, which, by the way, is a civil offense, not a criminal offense, has nothing to do with safety, then it makes the job harder for police, and in fact, it makes the whole community less safe.
And I think the point with it being a civil offense is also that people don't have the right to an attorney. And so you get into, they don't have a right to
a public defender.
And so you get into a situation where people are not represented. So they're, you know, they're sort of in a double bind. And the city has proposed this $1 million fund to help people who find themselves in that situation. But I mean, it really does hamper people's, I think, willingness to come forward to talk about domestic violence, to talk about, you know, whatever crime they've witnessed, or just to interact with police at all and to trust police at all if we get into a situation where police are enforcing federal law.
And the problem here in this era of alternative facts and fake news is there's this myth out there that what's happening is you have these violent, dangerous, illegal immigrants in and local law enforcement is protecting them from the feds. That is not true. If somebody is arrested and they end up in the King County Jail and federal authorities say there is a warrant for that person, they've been deported 6 times, they've committed 16 felonies, King County's not going to release them. They will turn them over to immigration. It's the other stuff that we've been talking about. So, but the Donald Trump supporters out there on the internet are just convinced that big city governments are intentionally hiding dangerous, you know, people from federal authorities.
We'll talk about fake news as commentated on by Como TV as required by their parent company a little bit later in the program. Before Erica, you want to say something before we leave the legal defense fund that Erica brought up? Chris Vance, do you have any? You don't live in Seattle, I know, but do you have any problem with a $1 million legal defense fund for undocumented immigrants?
No, not off the top of my head.
Let me just add too about that legal defense fund. The reason why it's important is because if you look at right now, people who are brought before the immigration court proceedings, over a third of them in Seattle have no representation at all. And you have, on the other side, you have the government, of course, with full-time attorneys. And then in Tacoma, which is noticeably basically a lower medium income and far more people who are very low income, 90% of the people there have no legal representation. So it's a setup situation for what we're doing is we're literally attacking and those people who are the most vulnerable. So that's why this is a wise investment.
Speaking of, yes, Erica?
Well, I want to pull back just for 1 second to talk about, you know, what the mayor has been doing and the theme that he's been hitting, because I think it's interesting. I think we're going to see it more in progressive cities. You know, he's been sort of criticized and praised for this, but he really is sort of running against Trump. And it is an election year.
Yes.
So that absolutely, you know, is.
And this, how everyone agrees, this helps Murray's reelection effort?
Absolutely.
Of course. But I do think it's he's doing it not just on immigration, but yesterday he made a statement about the about Congress effectively allowing states to yank Planned Parenthood funding because they oppose abortion, because politicians in those states oppose abortion. He made a statement about that. And I think, you know, one of the things he said during this immigration statement was that this is a war on cities, that the war on facts has become a war on cities. And I do think that cities are, you know, going to become the bulwarks against Trump even more as the administration goes on, because they represent everything that Trump is against. They represent diversity. They represent, you know, queerness. They represent intellectualism and curiosity and a lot of things that this sort of backward looking administration wants to erase, you know, and go back to the middle half of the 20th century. And so I think, you know, that divide is just going to become more and more. And the more people like Ed Murray speak about it, you know, the more that's going to become clear.
Well, one footnote, the cities do represent the majority of the popular vote that basically Trump did not get.
That's right. And suburbs. Yeah.
Well, metropolitan areas.
Well, then let's talk about how different cities, finally, as we're going to wrap up sanctuary cities here, but different cities are responding differently. You're all agreed that this fight is good for Mayor Murray's re-election chances. But there, you brought up Tacoma. Tacoma's not calling itself a sanctuary city. You don't. We said at the beginning, it's not a fixed term. So why would Seattle... maybe it's just politics, but you tell me, why even label Seattle a sanctuary city? If the city's just doing its job enforcing local laws, why say anything about it and label it?
Because, I guess I do every time I'm here. I live in
Auburn. You don't live in Seattle.
I live in Auburn. But Seattle city politics is all about who can get as far to the left as possible.
That's what you think is going on?
Absolutely. And Seattle politicians fight for who can get as far to the left as possible. Being really, really, really liberal is good in Seattle. That doesn't work anywhere else, but it is the key to political survival in the city of Seattle. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a fact.
Having represented that branch.
In fact, former city council member Nick Licata, didn't you introduce sanctuary city status?
Yes, it was my orders that got passed, right. And
so he just said that you were playing liberal politics.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, liberal, progressive, radical, whatever you want to use. Yeah. I'm going to answer your first question, though. Is why do cities even use the term sanctuary cities, and why do they go out of the way doing something of that sort? You know, I think the misguided as well, it's unique to Seattle. It isn't actually unique to Seattle. There's a number of other cities across the country have said that. But I think the cities that are the largest, the ones that actually have staffed up with their own attorneys, can better challenge the government. There are many smaller cities who cannot, who are very easily could be picked off by the federal government and punished. So it really falls on the shoulders of those cities that have greater resources, and they certainly also have greater exposure as far as their populations, to basically not let an unconstitutional action take place without being challenged. So it falls on us, the larger cities because we have the resources that we can challenge it.
And I think part of having those resources is that we will pay for things on our own if we have to. I mean, you just look at this homelessness levy, $275 million. If that passes, you know, we're going to be in a situation that is much more protected from federal cuts, which are coming, and state cuts, which are coming. And we're going to talk about the budget a little bit, but the Republican budget, you know, includes pretty significant cuts to homelessness programs. But if you're in a small city where, you know, you don't have that tax base, you don't have the, you know, necessarily the electorate that's going to say yes, increase my property taxes yet again for homelessness because that's a value that I care about, then it does become harder and you don't want to expose yourself that way.
We've been talking about the city of Seattle suing, quote unquote, suing the Trump administration over its threatening to withhold money from so-called sanctuary cities. And all three of my guests are Republicans and Democrats and what'd you call yourself? Wacky liberal? What did you say? Radical. Yeah, radical.
I use the word wacky.
Sorry. I can't remember how you said it. Yeah. You all seem to agree that that this lawsuit has, you know, has a lot of merit. And so did the former Republican Attorney General, Rob McKenna.
And I was about to say that. I read where Rob believes the same thing.
Yeah.
And of course, I don't know anybody who's more grounded and sober and thoughtful in these kind of things than Rob. And he doesn't take partisan positions. And if he thinks that Seattle is on solid ground, I'm not going to argue with Rob McKenna.
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, let me just add that I think really the genesis of this idea is not based really in public safety. It unfortunately, I think, represents some of the the ideology that has permeated the Trump administration through characters like Steve Bannon, the emphasis on ethnicity and basically the fear of groups that are different than you. And as a result, it's really dividing this country rather than creating a stronger country and a stronger community for all of us.
By the way, the Seattle Times reports that federal immigration agents just rounded up 84 people in the Northwest, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, 60 of them with criminal records. More to say about sanctuary cities and immigration and deportation in the days to come. Coming up on KUOW's Week in Review, what does Goodbye Pronto Bike Share say about our allegedly bike-loving city? And yes, we'll talk about Como TV being forced to air a fake news a related commentary, whether it wanted to or not, and more on the Week in Review. Stick around. Erica C. Barnett from the C is for Crank.com, former city council member, Seattle City Council member Nick Licata, former King County councilman, and other stuff. Republican Party Chair Chris Vance, and I'm Bill Radke, bringing you the Week in Review. New York City has a bike share on its streets. You need a bike? You pay for a bike. You ride the bike someplace. You return the bike at the nearest bike share station. San Francisco has it. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Austin, Chicago, D.C., Denver. Portland. Dozens of cities. Vancouver. Seattle did have bike share, but it's disappearing today. The city is packing up those lime green Pronto bikes because not enough people were using them. Did anybody here ever use a Pronto bike?
No.
Okay.
I have close friends.
I have my own bike.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's part of it, right? Some people would say if you want a bike, you can have a bike.
I think that Seattle has this, I've been here 15 years, and on issues that are divisive like this, Seattle has a way of always saying
bikes
we're...
divisive?
Yeah, is this divisive?
Seattle has a way of always saying that we're unique, and we are unlike all other cities in some way. And in the case of bike share, I think it was that we have hills.
Yes.
And that we have rain.
Yep.
So you just named a bunch of cities.
And bad traffic that even bikes have to share.
That's true. So you just named a bunch of cities that in various degrees share all those things. San Francisco is hillier than we are.
Yeah.
D.C., when bike share came in, they said, you know, the opponents said it's not going to work here because it's hot and humid for so much of the year. It's been incredibly successful.
Snowy in Boston where they have bike share, so for a chunk of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I have used bike
and
share.
And hot.
I have used bike share in D.C., and it is wonderful. It's so great to be able to do that last little bit of a trip, you know, or to go from neighborhood to neighborhood a short distance. And that was the point of bike sharing. And I think it's a really sad testament to Seattle that, you know, Pronto was sort of set up for failure. And then all these what I would consider bogus arguments about, you know, Seattle being completely unique among cities in its weather and hilliness were taken seriously. And I would put some of that on the mayor. In sort of delaying various rollouts of different, you know, new stations.
Is that how Pronto was set up for failure? What do you mean?
I think Pronto was set up for failure in a lot of ways. It was rolled out at the beginning of the rainy season. So, I mean, dumb move. The stations were really poorly spaced, and they were set up in such a way that they didn't form a network. I mean, the point of bike share is basically to do the last mile. Right. It's not to go all over town and that's your primary form of transportation. It's you take the bus downtown and then you have a meeting at South Lake Union. You pop on a Pronto and you bike half a mile or a mile. The station placement wasn't set up for that. And we kept sort of changing our tune. First, it was a nonprofit. Then we bought it. Then we were going to fix it. Then it took so long that we, you know, when the new rollout of the new stations was went into effect, it was October again. And there was so much uncertainty around it that people were dropping their memberships. And so, yeah, not enough people were using it because people were dropping off because it was never clear that if you bought a membership at the beginning of the year, that it would be valid at the end of the year. And in fact, people are getting big refunds right now because they signed up and now it's being canceled.
We have a tweet from a listener, Ray, who says, Seattle tried something new with Pronto and it didn't work. Time to learn from it and move on. Well, what are we supposed to learn from it? What about former city council member Nick Licata?
Right. You know, everything that that Erica said, I think, is accurate. There was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lack of actually a strategic plan. I think that the problem was probably in not devoting either sufficient city staff and transportation or working with people who had actually successfully gotten these rideshare programs up and running in other cities, because I think somewhat the mistake was probably we were so proud of ourselves of being so sustainable oriented, having a youth that have used bikes. I think what happened was we just plopped it down and said, oh, it's just going to grow. He's throwing seeds on the ground and it'll come up. And there was no real plan to figure out, as Erica said, where the stations are, how to support them, how to roll it out, the marketing, on a number of different sort of strategic levels, it failed. And if you don't basically put those resources in and have a strategic plan, you're going to end up with a failure, even in a city that prides itself on having people ride bikes.
Well, and just to add very quickly to that, they were going to switch to an all-electric system in response to the complaints about hills, which is just, to me, that just seemed crazy.
What's crazy about that?
It's expensive. It's harder to maintain. It's more expensive than just regular bikes. There was nothing wrong with the Pronto bikes. They were a little small for some very tall people, I've heard. But we don't need electric bikes to get around downtown Seattle. And it was a capitulation, and it was also another pivot that made the system just look like it was, you know, in shambles and in disarray.
Erica, I've been in other cities that have bikes. I don't remember seeing electric bikes in those cities.
It would have been the first one in America, I believe.
Uh-huh. San Franciscoans pedal up bikes without any assist?
Yeah, because it's a bike sharing program, and they know when they're getting on a bike, they know it's a bike.
So even though I don't live here, I shouldn't act like I never come here. I spend half my time in downtown Seattle. I work part-time in downtown Seattle. I think maybe one of the things that killed this project is during my lifetime, it's become exponentially easier to get around downtown Seattle than it used to be, with the bus tunnel turning into the light rail system and the streetcar and now Ubers and everything else.
So that's a happy reason for a bike share to fail.
But I'm listening to the former council member talk about if they didn't do a strategic plan to make sure there was actually a demand for this service, then somebody in city government was really negligent. I mean, I am the former chairman of the King County Council's Transportation Committee, and you don't build a road, you don't put in a crosswalk, you don't put in a bus route without making sure it's needed and will be used. And somebody didn't ask enough questions here to make sure there was actually a demand for this new service.
No one's brought up the fact that Seattle is the only American city, and I think there are very few worldwide, to require helmets. of bike share users.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was also part of the problem. They provided helmets on, you know, on demand at the stations. You'd have to, I think, pay for them. Like I said, I've never used the system. Okay, they were, Nick is shaking his head.
I don't know.
But
Cascade Bicycle Club said helmets discourage bike use, and the fewer riders there are, the more riders are in danger because drivers don't look for them.
Yeah, of course. And I think that the city has also neglected its bike infrastructure, particularly downtown. They're getting a little better about that from the point of view of bikers, but that was part of it. But certainly, helmet laws discourage biking. I mean, why would it be otherwise? And, you know, and in fact, the studies that have been done show that, you know, pretty conclusively that helmets, I mean, while in an individual case, if you hit your head, it's a lot safer to have a helmet on. But in bike sharing systems, you know, they don't significantly increase safety. So,
and some people are grossed out by bike helmets, which is the stupidest reason to.
I don't know. I'm kind of with them on that.
So the scourge of light head lice.
Sweaty head.
That's the real problem in this nation. Get on that, President Trump. Let's make America less sweaty head again. Do we lose any progressive liberal utopia points over this?
Well, I think it's an embarrassment for Seattle that we couldn't get this right when everybody else is getting it right, and when we're disabling the system right when Portland and Vancouver are going
expanding
online. So we're going to be the only Pacific Northwest city that doesn't have a bike sharing program, and so I think that's pretty embarrassing for us. Maybe we will learn from it, and maybe we'll get a better bike sharing system. In some future year.
If we miss it that much, we'll pay for it, right?
Well, I think one thing you have to keep in mind is, at least from what I've read, that they do plan on putting more investment in either bikeways or more, hopefully, signage or some sort of ability to make it safer to actually ride a bike in Seattle. When I was in Copenhagen on a trip to look at bicycling there, which has a huge percent of the population, it's like 25% getting downtown bikes. But in the past, early 70s, they were the same as Seattle. And what they did was, you have to make investment. If you don't make investment, people do feel fearful going out in traffic without a helmet. Not that it's going to make them a lot safer, but you need an infrastructure for bikes.
You know, I mean, I'm not a traffic engineer, but Seattle's a very unique. Oh, that's terrible. You should never use you're the unique or not unique.
We need to change that rule. I think everybody thinks you're a little bit unique or very unique, so we should change that rule.
But,
unique. Sorry, Latin root. We're taking over.
Think about Seattle. Our neighborhoods are divided by water and bridges or I-5. It's not one city. It's really a bunch of clusters. I mean, there's a really big difference between... I mean, try biking from West Seattle to Magnolia. I mean, how would you possibly do that?
And I can give you a route if you want.
Well, okay. But
quadriceps.
The neighborhoods in this town are so split up by geography and hills and I-5 and the Ship Canal, and that bike riding maybe isn't very practical in the city. I don't know.
Well, I mean, again, bike sharing is not for getting from West Seattle to Magnolia. Nobody expects you to get on a big, heavy Pronto bike and bike up the hill to the top of Magnolia. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to get off and walk this segment if we keep going.
All right.
Okay. I'm going to get exhausted. That's bike share. It's going away. Maybe it'll come back. We'll miss it. We'll see. More on KUOW's Week in Review with Erica C. Barnett and Chris Vance and Nick Licata coming up. Hey there. Listen, you like listening to Week in Review in your car or your kitchen or maybe your job? Come see us in person right here at the KUOW studios, Friday, April 14th. I'll be on spring break, but Luke Burbank, who's far better than I am, Luke Burbank will be here, and so can you be. Just open up a new email message. Do it right now. Don't wait. Open up a new message. Put Week in Review Live in the subject line. Week in Review Live, and send it to engage@kuow.org. engage@kuow.org. We'll pick 5 people to each get a pair of tickets. You've got until tonight at 8:00 to get that in. So don't wait. Get that email to us, engage@kuow.org, and we hope to see you there. I'm Bill Radke. Let's continue now our Week in Review. Tomorrow, April 1st, car tab fees begin to kick in from the voters' approval of Sound Transit 3. And we are going to be talking about a few things regarding Sound Transit. You know, some car owners are upset to find out that when Sound Transit calculates their car tab fees, your formula inflates the Sound Transit formula inflates the market value of a used car. And also, the Washington State Senate has passed a bill that would basically fire all the Sound Transit board members and replace them with 11 directly elected board members, because right now they're from their mayors or their county council members, et cetera. So all that's going on. And in the middle of it, we had the CEO of Sound Transit, Peter Rogoff, on here yesterday. And I asked him about the criticism that with the car tab fees, Sound Transit is ripping people off. I guess voters want to know, is this fair? Can you tell voters this is fair to them?
Fairness.
Car owners.
I think in a perfect world, everyone would agree, and the Sound Transit board agrees, that ideally we would value the cars at precisely what they're valued. But as you said, there are two schedules in the law. Neither of them are actually exactly at what a car is valued at.
Do you think Sound Transit's going to give back, quote unquote, any of that money?
The Sound Transit
at the extreme end, Tim Iman is saying $6 billion, that's not yours, it's ours. But do you think Sound Transit's going to give up, you know, you're going to use that money to build your project. So is Sound Transit going to end up forfeiting any of that money and not building or delaying any projects?
The Sound Transit Board is committed to trying to see if there's a solution to this problem that will allow us to move to the newer depreciation schedule sooner. The challenge is this, and you said it yourself, we have an obligation to the voters as a result of the last ballot measure to deliver a series of projects over the next 25 years. And we can't put revenues at risk that would endanger our ability to fulfill our commitment to the voters.
Chris Vance, were you on Sound Transit Board as a King County Council member?
No, I never was. I had enough other things. No, I was never. Back then, we called it the RTA Board. I left before they actually changed the branding from the Regional Transit Authority actually to Sound Transit. I was on a number of other regional boards and commissions. But this issue is a big deal. Voters are going to remember this. It's going to be the centerpiece in campaigns now for city council, county council, governor, if certain people run for governor at some point.
So then you're saying the Sound Transit board members are accountable because they're going to be held accountable to their voters in their cities or counties, et cetera.
They are indirectly, but you know, this is ripping off the scabs in some of the oldest debates in this region that I have been a part of. I was elected to the county council after the voters merged Metro with King County, because the old Metro board, which used to govern our regional transit system, was found to be unconstitutional, because they were not directly elected. So the idea was the county council would be more directly elected. People have complained about this forever, and there is no bigger, more historic fight in this region than light rail. And there's a lot of people out there who hate light rail. I don't. I ride it constantly. But there's a whole lot of conservatives who despise light rail.
And there's no bigger historic fight, except voters said yes over and over.
You know what?
Most recently to Sound Transit, number three.
Every voter.
$54 billion total.
It failed everywhere other than the city of Seattle. It failed everywhere south of I-90. That is absolutely true. Go down to Pierce County and ask voters.
Well, Pierce, it passed in Snohomish and King.
Yeah, it always fails in Pierce.
It passed in Snohomish and King, but only because of Seattle. I voted for it.
But I'm not
attacking it. I'm just stating facts. That to a lot of suburban voters, they are angry. They voted against this. They never ride it. They don't want it. And now their car tabs are going up. So I'm just saying, I'm not saying Sound Transit's wrong.
Well, Seattle only has a third of King County's voters. They may have disproportionately, but you still had many, many people suburbs voting.
The way math works is when one region votes overwhelmingly, they outvote everybody else. I mean, if were it not for the city of Seattle, Rob McKenna would have been governor by 87,000 votes. Yep. Seattle is able to outvote.
But that kind of logic avoids the discussion of it's one person, one vote.
I understand that.
So,
and I am
right.
not.
You
I
know,
am,
that's how we decide.
Yeah. I am not. You think I'm launching an attack on Sound Transit. I'm not.
I hear
I'm
you're saying you're not.
I'm not.
It sounds more like an attack on Seattle.
I am not.
And our voters.
I am not doing either. All I'm saying is this is going to have political repercussions for a long time. And people should, the state Senate is really serious about this. And this is going to be a big deal.
I think the thing about when you said that a lot of people are angry about their...
They are.
I'm actually referring back to what Bill said about people being mad about their taxes going up. That is absolutely true, but it's specific people, and it's the people who own cars that are more recent vintage.
You're talking specifically about the car tab fee valuations.
Yeah, right. Higher value, but also just newer cars. So,
and there are other taxes too, but yeah.
If the car valuation changed in the way that the Republicans want, it would give a tax break to people who are able to afford newer cars, and it would actually make taxes more expensive, and it would increase what people who own cars older than 11 years would pay.
So, but are you fine with the fact that the valuation doesn't reflect the market value of your used car?
No valuation is ever going to do that. We had this issue with the monorail as well. What the problem with the MVET is that people feel it all at once, and so
this is motor vehicle excise tax.
Sorry,
by the way.
Correct. And people feel it all at once because you pay it when you renew your car tabs, and people get very upset when a tax goes up from say $150 to $200. We pay a lot more in sales tax. You know, thousands of dollars more, in fact, than any of us pay in car tab taxes, but we don't notice it as much because we pay it a little at a time. And so that's a fundamental issue that's always going to make these taxes more controversial. But the question is, when you're talking about fairness, there's a 1999 valuation that Sound Transit is using, and there's a 2006 valuation that Republicans want Sound Transit to use.
Well, it was approved, and Sound Transit says we're going to use it, but it's going to take years for us to use that value.
It's going to take until 2028 when the move, I can't remember the name of the original ballot measure, but when the original bonds are played
expired,
out,
paid
expired.
Off.
Yeah. So, I mean, what Sound Transit could do now, and what I guess Tim Iman and the Republicans want them to do, is to pull out of the bonds and essentially issue new bonds under the new evaluation, and that would lose $6 million. That's Ballard to downtown. That's that entire light rail segment would be gone. So
billion.
$6 billion.
Yeah. That's what they're saying.
By the way, if you're screaming at your radio right now, don't do it alone. Add to the conversation. We're live tweeting this program at KUOW. Yes, go on.
But fundamentally, every car tab evaluation is going to be unfair in some way, one way or the other. Too expensive, not expensive enough, because it's not done by your individual car. They're not going to come out and look at your car and decide.
Listener wants to know, yeah. I think, for one big one is Sound Transit going to, this is what you heard me asking the CEO, obviously he doesn't want to do that. Does anyone here think that Sound Transit is going to give up billions of dollars and delay or cancel any of its light rail
not voluntarily.
Plus commuter rail
not
project.
Voluntarily, right. But it.
But do you think it'll happen?
If there's a financial crush. Now, let's just back away for a second and look at this. The Erica's point is good. There's never going to be a perfect evaluation. At one time, they talked about using the Kelly book, which would totally not work because it's a moving target. I think Sound Transit is exaggerating the loss in some ways. I noticed they're talking about a $6 billion loss if they move the 2006 schedule up. But in their information I've seen on the classic pie chart, they have a total of $6.9 million coming from car tabs. So that doesn't make sense. They're not losing 90% of the revenue. So one of the problems I think that the public has had, and I've had in the past, one of the first things I got involved with, is oversight over Sound Transit. This gets back to more than just who is on it. You really do need, I think, an ongoing third party looking at the financing, not just the management, but looking at basically where the money's going and how it's being spent. Because I think that's probably going to concern people more than anything else, because if you actually break down that $54 billion over the next 25 years, it comes out to $7,000 per taxpayer in Pierce, Snohomish, and King County, $280 a year, something like that. So the number sounds huge. It is big, but if you actually stretch it out through the period of time, and that's not just car tabs, that's everything. That's a property tax, it's the sales tax. But people want to know they're getting their money's worth. I think that's what's really critical.
But I think it's also relevant that we did just vote for Sound Transit 3, and this is actually the will of the people.
No, it is. But I think people want to maintain that trust.
Final word, Chris Vance.
Okay. again, I'm not talking about the substance of it, but on the politics of it. First of all, the people who have been running Sound Transit, which so far, the main political drivers on the Sound Transit board are the three county executives, Pierce King and Snohomish County. And they're all liberal Democrats. And I'm not disparaging anyone, but I think the general attitude is we have fought over light rail in this region for decades. We know this is going to be politically hard. We know it's going to cause pain. But by God, we're going to do it. No matter come hell or high water, no matter what the objections, we're going to power through it. We're going to do it. The change now is there's now a Republican county executive in Pierce County, Bruce Dammeyer. And if there's going to be a political challenge to the prevailing thinking in the Sound Transit Board, it's going to come from Pierce County. So I watch for that. And we'll see how the change in Pierce County is becoming more and more Republican. And let's see how that changes the Sound Transit Board.
Okay, so if Sound Transit has to give up any of its money, it's not going to slow down the Issaquah, Redmond, Everett, Linwood lines. Pierce County, maybe we're looking at you. Well, okay, we got to go. Move on. We've got to talk about this fake news related commentary on Cuomo, and is the state of Washington finally about to fully fund education? Coming up on the Week in Review. The Week in Review on this Friday on KUOW Seattle with Chris Vance, Nick Licata, and Erica C. Barnett. The parent company, by the way, we're live tweeting the show at KUOW, so join us as Ray did earlier, talking Pronto Bike Share. Now, the parent company of Cuomo TV, a politically conservative company called Sinclair Broadcast Group, made Cuomo air a commentary about fake news. Here's a big part of it.
Hi, I'm Scott Livingston, Vice President of News for this television station. We know our greatest responsibility is serving our local communities. I'm extremely proud of the journalism that this station produces. But I'm sure you know about the troubling trend of irresponsible and one-sided news stories plaguing our country. The sharing of bias and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, national media outlets are publishing these fake news stories without fact-checking. Unfortunately, some members of the national media are using their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think. This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Crosscut reports that Cuomo News staff were livid about the suggestion that legitimate news outlets are airing, as President Trump says, fake news, and that Cuomo was being required to disseminate that. Erica C. Barnett, what do you think the Sinclair executive wanted viewers to take away from that commentary?
Please discount everything you hear on this station. It is quite possibly done without fact-checking, and don't believe the mainstream media. I think it's a completely undermining message.
What do you think the executive wanted? What was the intent?
What was his? I think that's what was expressed. I suppose his intent was to suggest that that the Fox News model is maybe a better model. It boggles my mind as a journalist and as somebody who's worked for a lot of publications with, you know, with good principles and with standards, that this would ever happen on a mainstream TV station. It actually really shocks me and is frightening to me for the future of journalism. And I'm really glad to see that people at the station are fighting back and are doing what they can to say this is not what these are not our values. But I think, you know, to answer your question, I think he's saying, you know, I'm the boss now, and this is the new order, and this is how things are going to work.
I think it's totally hypocritical of Livingston and the Sinclair Company. It's interesting because, you know, Jared Kushner had been at a business meeting with other business leaders and mentioned how they, the Trump campaign, had come to an agreement with the with Sinclair, which controls 173 stations news stations around the country, that they would broadcast Trump interviews without commentary. That's certainly one-sided, and given what information that Trump is giving out has been seen again and again to be inaccurate, if not outright wrong and misleading, that is a practice that, in fact, Sinclair has been promoting.
Mm. Chris, you're just one Republican. What's your take on
that? Well, just if you don't know the bias or agenda of this company, the Sinclair company, the commentary itself is so vague. I don't know if he was criticizing Fox for being biased or CNN for being biased.
He wasn't specific.
Yeah, it wasn't specific at all. I mean, my view is that the commentary itself was stupid. I mean, it didn't really portray any message. I don't know what he was saying.
I think the attempt was, viewers, you've heard about fake news, including from, you know, President Trump's talking about, everyone's talking about fake news. I think he was trying to say, you can trust Cuomo, we don't do fake news.
Yeah. Well, and he's talked about fake news, which is one particular thing, but then the other thing is bias.
Yeah.
And he accused national media of being biased, but I don't know if he meant Fox or he meant the New York Times.
Well, and
I think we all assume because it's Sinclair what he means, but I agree with Erica. I'm scared to death, or journalism is circling the drain here. People are trusting everything less and less. If they hear anything from any source that they don't agree with, they don't trust it. And I don't know what to do about it. It's bad.
And I think that this narrative that Livingston is passing along is very much a Trump narrative that was in response to the presence of actual fake news. Remember, that term actually used to mean something not very long ago, just a couple of
Russian
months.
Bot news and
it
stuff.
It was
pizzeria, Hillary Clinton and pizzeria.
Teenagers in Macedonia.
Yes, but let's remember that for the past 8 years, everybody else has been saying, I mean, people on the left have been saying Fox is fake news. So people on the right think fair is fair. If you're going to criticize my TV station and say it's biased, I'm going to criticize your TV station.
There's
people weren't saying Fox was kind of fake news. It was just unbalanced.
There's a big difference between.
All right, fine. Biased. Fine. I don't know how many times I saw Fox spelled F-A-U-X, by the way. I mean, so now the liberals complaining about Donald Trump being mistreated in this way, the other side has no sympathy or credibility with it because they feel like their side has been demonized. It's a free fire zone out there, and everyone's getting hurt.
Well, I think that you're setting liberals and conservatives as the two sides in this, but I would see this as journalists versus ideologues. And the journalists that I know who work, you know, for TV, radio, you, Bill, me, you know, we might have biases, but what he's, you know, because we're all human beings, but what he's accusing reporters of doing is making up the news. And reporters take that very seriously. I mean, the main target of this has been the New York Times, mm-hmm. which is a venerable and really credible news source. Donald Trump is out there every day saying that the New York Times, CNN are fake news. And that is a real, that is a threatening allegation. And it's a false allegation, in my opinion. And I think that it has a real, deadening effect on journalism. I think it's going to create a brain drain from organizations like Cuomo. I think journalists are going to flee because they don't want to work for an organization whose president undermines them in such a public way.
But the journalists are fighting back. The union at Cuomo, the IATSE 600, has actually created a committee on journalistic ethics.
That's the editor and photographers union. Before this particular commentary.
That's right.
They were campaigning about what they think about Sinclair's biased management.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's change the channel on that for the moment. That's the Sinclair Broadcasting commentary aired on Seattle's Cuomo TV. We're going to wrap up this week in review with the fact that we got a glimpse at how Washington state lawmakers might fully pay for schools, which they are under a court order to do. They need to spend billions. Democrats want to raise several taxes, including a new state tax on capital gains. That's the money you make when you sell an investment like stocks or a house. More on that in a moment. Republicans have a different plan. They want to cut the budget, and this is the big idea, impose a statewide property tax to pay for education and remove the local property tax levies that we use for schools now. First, and we have 5 minutes left, 4.5 minutes left. First of all, capital gains tax, that's been found, an income tax has been found unconstitutional, but aren't capital gains income?
Well, that's
the money
be
comes
decided,
in. That's
going to be decided by the courts.
Of course
right.
it is.
That's,
of course it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but you know, here's the basic problem we're facing, not just in Washington State, but across the country, is that more and more people are deriving their income not from wages, but from investments.
Right.
And that is skewing the burden of basically paying for public services. So
right.
the capital gains tax is way overdue in readjusting that balance.
Yeah, but you're saying it's income as well, and so is Chris.
The issue here is how we constitutionally fund our schools. That's the issue. And I spent past 8 years working on this with Randy Dorn. The issue here is using local levies to pay for schools is unconstitutional. It always has been. There has to be a new state revenue source to pay for our schools. Raising taxes, as the Democrats are proposing in the House, which they can't get the votes for in the House, will never pass the state Senate. The only way the legislature is going to get a deal on education is if they use the so-called levy swap model, which is you lower the local property taxes and raise a state property tax, which, by the way, this idea first came from a Democrat, Ross Hunter, the former chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. The Republicans.
And it means the rich districts are going to pay more, right?
Most
your Seattle
people,
and Bellevue. And,
no, not the rich districts. Seattle School District doesn't write a check.
No.
Taxpayers do.
Taxpayers in those property-rich
right.
areas.
And most people across the state get a tax cut. Some people get a tax increase, but this would actually pass the legislature.
The difference, the reason that the Republicans support this particular tax increase, as they're calling it, is because it does hit the districts that vote Democratic.
That's not it why. Hits, that it, is not why.
It hits Seattle. But it hits Bellevue. It hits Mercer Island. Bill, your property taxes are going to go up by more than $1,000 a year, most likely, out on Mercer Island. Seattle's are going to go up $600, $700 a year, depending on valuation. Meanwhile, rural districts that vote for Republicans, their property taxes are going
to
go down.
This is so frustrating to me because, and it always has been, people have got to break out of this idea that schools are something we fund locally. That's how the other 49 states fund their schools. Our Constitution is different. The word local control is not in our Constitution. The word uniform is. So yes, people in Seattle make more money. So they pay more sales taxes. So they fund all sorts of services in Eastern Washington. And we have to start thinking of our schools the same way, as one unified school system. And rich people who get to live in Seattle and Bellevue are going to pay more for the state's schools than poor people who live in Eastern Washington.
It seems
but it's poor
you're...
people who live in major metropolitan areas as well as Seattle. But I think we're also missing another element, as I understand it, on the proposal that came out of the Senate Republicans, is that they're also talking about basically rejecting state worker contracts, about cutting government.
Well, that,
cutting
no, that's in their budget.
Managers.
That's in the
no,
budget.
Well, that's
not the McCleary plan.
But that all contributes to helping to fund McCleary, and as well as eliminating a number of state programs. So there's a whole package there you have to take into consideration. In fact, I haven't seen the numbers that the plan to reshuffle the property tax actually ends up with a significant increase. I imagine these other cuts are also what's really driving the...
There's a lot
we have
of,
1 minute left. Erica C. Barnett.
Yeah, I just want to jump on that. There's a lot of cuts in the Senate budget, the Republican budget, that would specifically hurt the poor people that that Chris is talking about. There's cuts to homelessness programs. There's cuts to housing programs that that serve people who are disabled, blind. They're saving a lot of money on the backs of the very most vulnerable people in our state. And so I think that concern for the poor is not what's motivating either the McCleary budget proposal out of the Republicans or the Republicans' state budget.
You'll hear much more about that coming budget negotiation as the session possibly ends, probably goes into a special session. We'll see. You'll hear about it on KUOW. You've been listening to Erica C. Barnett. The C is for crank.com. Former city council member Nick Licata, former state Republican Party chair, King County Councilman Chris Vance. I want to thank you all.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for listening to KUOW Seattle.